Good evening. You're either watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. I'm with David Frank. My name is Eric Kirk. We are discussing national political news of the day, and we are going to first discuss something that's been rendered kind of moot, at least for the time being, but the administration in its flurry of executive orders, freezing all kinds of funding, foreign aid funding, also freezing litigation in the filed by the government for civil rights and environmental issues. Everything is being frozen while the administration reviews everything that is happening in light of its intended policies. I'll tell you, if they're freezing their activity in lawsuits, if I'm like an attorney who's on the other side of any of those lawsuits, I'm going to take advantage of it. I'm going to file motions and all kinds of things while their activity is frozen. There's probably exceptions, but it's probably going to cause some chaos. But there also has been freezes in spending, and especially one that was that froze all grants, loans, and financial aid of sorts. It caused a bit of chaos early on. All 50 states' Medicaid portal was shut down. That may have been a problem that's not related to the order. The White House is being real cagey about that, saying it'll be back online soon. So we don't know if somebody hit the wrong button or something. But anyway, a number of states have filed lawsuits, I think about 22 of them totally, against this particular order. Also, a conglomeration of nonprofits have filed a lawsuit. The orders have already drawn dozens of lawsuits. The list is getting longer. Every order, pretty much, that he's done, well, partly because they're so radical, is getting at least one lawsuit in opposition. And already two injunctions have been granted. Last week, the order for birthright citizenship to cancel birthright citizenship for anybody born to undocumented immigrants was hit with a temporary injunction by a Reagan-appointed judge who just said that this is easily the most unconstitutional order that he's actually had to deal with in his four decades on the federal bench. That's not a good sound. I mean, that's a very conservative judge. It doesn't sound good for the future of that order. But for Trump, a lot of it is about performance, about throwing stuff out there for his fans, and then just saying, well, the courts are blocking me. I mean, so at any rate, an injunction was also issued against the executive order and the Office of Management and Budget memo to basically ban all sorts of spending across the board. An injunction was opposed by a judge of the District of Columbia yesterday, and after what appears to have been some backdoor pressure, probably from Republicans saying, you know, you're killing us. The order has been rescinded, although there is a very confusing post on Truth Social from Caroline Leavitt, who's saying this is not a rescission of the federal funding freeze. It is simply a rescission of the OMB memo. Well, that was the order. That was the funding freeze. Why? To end any confusion created by the court's injunction. The president's EOs on federal funding remain in full force and effect and will be rigorously implemented. So there are some other orders that are preventing funding, but right now it is frozen. Real quickly, in order to obtain an injunction, a lot of people are saying, well, it's just a temporary injunction, that doesn't mean anything. But to obtain even a temporary injunction or temporary restraining order, you have to make a showing of a substantial likelihood of prevailing on the merits. And certainly the judge on the birthright citizenship case was impressed with the plaintiff's case on that. And again, it was filed by the ACLU, a whole bunch of states and other immigrant advocacy groups that are joining it. But this, it also had to be found here as to whether or not Donald Trump even, or the presidency even, has the authority to rescind spending, which was basically originated from Congress, and whether or not this is an interference with congressional spending power. And we ran into this 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, whenever it was, that he threatened to withhold aid to Ukraine unless they would give him some dirt on Biden that he could use in the election. And the question came up then, but then the aid was released. Trump does seem to feel like he's got the authority to do this. And ordinarily I'd say no way, but again, you know, some of these cases are going to make their way up to the Supreme Court, and he's going to have some wins there because he's got some pretty extreme people on the Supreme Court backing him. A lot more to say about this, Dave, but I'm going to let you jump in.
Well, thank you for that setup. As always, this is one of those things that's moving fast, and there are multiple lines of communication on this. So different media outlets are reporting it slightly differently. I do appreciate the fact that you pointed out that Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt posted out there on X that, in fact, even though everyone is covering it, that this has been rescinded, only the memo was rescinded, not the mission, basically, was what she was saying. So it was, in effect, it was a way to signal to people, don't worry, this was just a little bit of a growing pains experience, but we all still have our eye on the prize. So what does that mean? Basically, the way you introduced it was exactly right. There's a acting OMB director until the nominee actually gets a hearing in front of the Senate. So really, I think that's the key figure here is that nominee, Russell Voigt. It turns out that he actually is the author of Project 2025's second chapter, where he talks about bringing the federal bureaucracy in line using the power of the OMB. And sure, there's lots of detail there, but one of the key things is, one of the most important tools that the president has is to tame the bureaucracy in the administrative state by turning on and off any spending going to the agencies. So that's a theory that they have, but they are behaving, they are acting, they are planning as if they are intending to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. They published, you know, Trump actually had a similar argument in his Agenda 47 when he said, oh, I'm not actually, I don't even know what Project 2025 is, which you could take that with a grain of salt. But the truth is he wanted to distance himself from it because he knew it was unpopular. Really, the main claim here from the Heritage Foundation, from the Project 2025 side, is that the president has the authority to keep spending in alignment with the president's priorities. So that's how they're proceeding. I think Trump was a little bit more focused. I looked at a video that he prepared as part of his campaign back in June, where he said, like, he totally believes in the power of the president to that impoundment power, which is basically to not spend money allocated by congressional law. So the law says, the Constitution says, as we know, I think we buried the lead here, that Congress gets to decide the purse strings. They set the priorities, they set the funding, and then it gets implemented.
Tax and spend for the general welfare, first, one of the first lines in Article 2.
Exactly that, right? But Trump's video that he posted on his campaign site was called Using Impoundment to Cut Waste, Stop Inflation, and Crush the Deep State. So that was back in June. Really briefly, President Nixon back in 1974, obviously there was an abuse of power issue that was reined in by Congress afterwards. And that Impoundment Control Act of 1974 basically said that under only very limited conditions can the president not spend the money that was allocated by Congress. And that was further refined in 1987 when they clarified deferrals. So deferral was when you like you defer spending, which is a temporary block. So these are principles that have been around for 50 years. They've been refined more recently. Like I said, 87 by Congress. So there are specific laws that affect these actions and these priorities and these decisions from the administration. So this administration early on, just week one, went on a collision course with the law intentionally, with the hopes of fighting it in court. And they said so early and often throughout the process. And we could talk a little bit more, but the idea is that I would argue, when it pivots back to me, I would argue that they were always going to do this. And even though there is a court order, and even though they said they rescinded the memo, there are still plans to kind of see this thing through.
Oh, definitely. They're going to push and push and push and push. And right now, they've got support from Congress, from at least the Republican majority in the House. Literally, some of them don't understand that Congress has spending power and what that means. I mean, literally, they did not understand that. They didn't know anything about the impoundment. I mean, it's embarrassing what they don't know, or at least what they say they don't know. Yes, a lot of spending bills give discretion to the presidency, but it still has to be spent on those projects. He doesn't get to cancel it. That has to be done by an act of Congress. This is huge. It goes straight to Vance's, we need to get over our dictator phobia type thing, because this is really an imperial presidency on the move. It is probably one of the biggest measures. I mean, the president has become more and more powerful over the past 150 years, started with Andrew Jackson, just because, having the direct hands-on power gives you whatever what you actually need to do it, and you got to be challenged. And for instance, when the Supreme Court told Andrew Jackson he had to honor the treaties with the Cherokee and the rest, he just ignored it and said, "Send your army if you don't agree with me." And unfortunately, the Supreme Court didn't scream about it loudly enough, and he got away with it. This is why Andrew Jackson is Trump's favorite president. And so he is just basically going to take that position, and it'll be interesting to see what he does, because he can stall things long enough before a court tells him to stop that he can really hurt organizations and people. The Medicaid thing was probably a mistake. They probably, didn't think in terms of the impact on it and maybe some of the other programs. So they're probably going to, take it a little more carefully with the next step. But no, he wants to do it, but he's going to need congressional empowerment to be able to do it. Congress is going to have to pass another bill that gives them this discretion. It's going to be fought, and then there'll be a filibuster in the Senate, and then there'll be a question as to whether or not you can override it. But you can only do that so many times, there's so much to say here, but it is not legal what he's doing. We are moving into an era where maybe whether something is legal that the president does is no longer applicable, and certainly not if the other branches of government don't stand up to him. The courts did, by the way. The courts, he sent out a memo to every judge in person, and the courts did tell him, "Hey, knock it off. These are our employees," that type of thing. But we'll see what Congress does.
Yeah, there are so many elements to this, as you mentioned. I'd rather focus a little bit on what happened as opposed to what Congress might do, only because I think Congress is obviously majority in GOP hands, both the Senate and the House. And they're just kind of, as people do make a public statement, they're mostly just saying, well, this is what Trump campaigned on. They appear not to engage on the merits versus that, and that's the president's party, the GOP. But whereas the opposite is true of the Democrats, obviously, which we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But the idea is that the Democrats are This memo just came out on Monday, and it's already gone through several vacillations. And today's only Wednesday as we're having this conversation. So a lot has happened. It came out Monday night, too. So a lot's happened in 48 hours. And in a sense, this is like a shock and awe plan. All these executive orders across all these different elements, kind of pushing everybody onto the back foot. It's an example, as you mentioned, of the imperial presidency. It's a way to wield power, and it's a sign of saying, hey, I made these promises. I'm going to stand firm. I'm going to push forward. And in effect, say, I don't really care if it's legal. I'm going to do what I said I was going to do.
Yeah. But
I just want to go to the actual, like, what is it that happened? So Matthew Vaith, who's the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, he basically said, my interpretation of this is that there was a little bit of a messaging problem. The Project 2025 folks, the Heritage Foundation folks, the Trump campaign have been working on this for a long time, and they have all kinds of ideas, all sorts of implementation plans. But the actual memo that went out is really that it was like a messaging problem. For example, I'm going to give a quote. It was more of a like an ideological shot across the bow, almost like a victory strut. It said the use of federal resources to advance Marxist equity, transgenderism, and Green New Deal social engineering policies is a waste of taxpayer dollars that does not improve day-to-day of the lives of those we serve. And this quote was, this is to paraphrase, to bring federal spending in alignment with Trump's values and vision for the country. So, for example, on LGBTQ issues, on civil rights, on energy and environmental policy, the executive actions that we've already seen, they were basically saying like, hey, we are going to review everything and put it through the filter of our priorities.
Right.
Review was the key. I think everything that they talked about and they strategized about was the review part. But it turns out that really what got published was freeze. And one indication of that kind of crosswires within the administration was on Tuesday, like you mentioned, all 50 states, their equivalent of their Health and Human Services divisions were locked out of the Medicaid website. So they couldn't even go in to their traditional electronic interface with the federal government where they go to manage their Medicaid dollars.
I think we're way over our 2 minutes, but if you want to quickly wrap this up.
Yeah, I'll wrap it up. And it really does segue into the next topic. But the idea is that they really, people saw that, hey, wait, they said freeze, and it looks like Medicaid's frozen. So what happened here? And so they released a memo, and the memo said, well, actually, the agencies are only required to pause funding on activities that conflict with these executive orders and the vision and the priorities. So then there was another memo that was released that said, well, actually, it's really only going to freeze the money that goes, it's not going to freeze the money that goes to individuals. So don't worry about Medicaid. Don't worry about food stamps. It's really just to organizations. But the complexity of the government, the complexity of funding worked against them. And there was just must have been some massive pushback.
So the next topic is really related. Project 2025, we've talked about on this show. Of course, Trump denied that he was going to implement it. He denied even knowing what it was, even though he's got people in his cabinet that are like helped write it, as you discussed on the last show. Project 2025 is basically a blueprint to completely restructure government and possibly tear everything down and start over with the power of the presidency. And they do have power of Congress, although they've got a limitation that they have to be concerned if they're going to have, unless they're not going to allow further elections, then nothing matters. But he already is checking off boxes. That one of his orders is to cut funding from any school that teaches critical race theory or radical gender theory. And of course, it doesn't really define them. And so basically it's, this is, and the question is whether or not that's even legal. If schools are in compliance with the federal regulations pertaining to education, they are entitled to their funding, and there's going to be lawsuits about that. But this is what he's doing. He has ushered in a bunch of executive orders that are creating chaos. And normally a president doesn't want chaos, right? They want to be able to do their job in the absence of it, but he seems to revel in it. And I think they're hoping that they can get a lot of stuff done before the states and the courts and everybody else catch up to them. And he's checked off a number of boxes, you know, the order about transgender, the order, various things that fit on, and we can even get kind of, there's a kind of a list of things that he's attempted. Now, there's things on the list that I don't know how he intends to fulfill, like getting rid of no-fault divorce or something like that. That's a state law thing. Some states don't have it, and some do. But obviously, this offering of a buyout of federal workers, that is very consistent with Project 2025, because it's kind of a threat. Hey, you can get this deal, might not be available come, you know, September when we start axing people. So this is your chance to take it now. I'm sure the union's going to file a lawsuit about the fact that they even sent that memo out. But they're sending it out and everybody's in fear, and some people probably will take that deal if it doesn't get shut down real quickly, like some of these other orders. There's so much to talk about with this, Dave. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Oh, well, thank you. So one thing that we didn't talk about yet is the fact that these, Project 2025 included a section on mass deportations. And so that's one of the, I would say, the most forward and aggressive sets of executive orders and actions and priorities for this administration, quite frankly. So Stephen Miller is out there saying, fighting representing the administration's decisions to follow through with those elements from Project 2025, and also, to a certain extent, we could call them threats, but mostly they were saying, "Oh, we're going to focus on criminals." But we know that, you and I have talked about this, that that's, you know, we're talking a small percentage of the 10 or so million undocumented people, here in the United States are actually criminals, and so they've got, how are they going to even manage that? You know, they're talking about possibly trying to get 1,500 people per day, and they're not meeting some quota. Well, if you really are looking to get criminals, you don't need a quota. You need to go after the people on your list, right? So there's a lot of, this is about the presentation and about sticking to the promises of the campaign, knowing what the priorities are of the base. So there's that key element. But the Project 2025 also included, you know, a lot of the other elements, like, for example, limiting voter access. So one of the things that came up recently was there's some talk about how there would be linkage between aid disaster relief for the LA fires in exchange for Governor Gavin Newsom supporting an ID being required to vote. So this is a way of saying, hey, we've got this tangible thing that we really want to try to get through, and we'll try to use power relationships to do it.
And he just assumes that Governor Newsom has the authority to do that without the legislature's help. He's just this executive power everywhere. He makes that assumption. It's ridiculous. I mean, that requires a whole new law. And there's no way it would make it through the legislature. So are they going to deny the aid? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. So I think it's important to mention, like, just the scope. Obviously, another pillar of this is is rolling back talk about equity, diversity, equity, and inclusion, both in the workplace, in the federal government, employment conditions, and the military, but also the private sector and schools. So there are key elements of Project 2025, but we're seeing elements of it unfold in these executive orders. So, for example, the response to this, Senator Merkley from Oregon, his quote is, "We're in the midst of a sweeping authoritarian power grab that has never been witnessed in the lifetime of anyone standing here now." Senator Schumer has said a lot of things, but one of the things that he said was, quote, "Plain and simple, this is Project 2025, Project 2025 by another name. They knew how unpopular it was. The right-wing ideologues are still in control, so they had to do it a different way. But it has the same consequences, and we have the same horrible, negative, overwhelming reaction from the American people." And actually, he's making the connection between our last segment, Senator Schumer, when he says, "And who's going to be the implementer of this? None other than the chief cook and bottle washer of Project 2025, Russell Voigt, who is nominated to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget," which he describes it as the air traffic controller of the White House, because all the budget plans start there, and then the implementation of the executive execution of Congress's budget priorities goes through there too. So in a way, the Democrats are putting their finger on it using the tried and true technique of cause and effect, saying, "Hey, this is intentional. And look at what's happening." And then the flip side of that is, if you look at the Republican response, I have a quote here from Roger Severino, director of domestic policy at Heritage Foundation and a co-author. He said, "The ideas that are being implemented are the ones the president's been talking about throughout his campaign. Rein in the bureaucracy, attack the deep state, upend the Justice Department. It's the president who announced he was going to do this, and we finally have a president who's willing, who's fulfilling his promises." So that's the stage is set, right? Like the players have taken the field. We know what to expect. Project 2025 is a 922-page policy roadmap, and key elements of it and key personnel are in place, and we're seeing the fruits of it, and everybody's being pretty transparent about it.
Again, looking at some of the items on the list, and Vance's guru, I'm forgetting his name, has said is, everything needs to be burned down.
Peter Thiel or Yarvin?
Yarvin, yeah.
Curtis Yarvin, yeah.
Yeah, we need to get over our fear of dictator or dictator phobia or whatever. I mean, the model really is a singular person, a CEO of the country to be able to do this. And Johnson is showing that he's willing to do that. He went down to Mar-a-Lago and took instruction to remove, somebody we talked about last week from the intelligence committee, and he just did it. I mean, that is a capitulation that is in such defiance of the constitutional checks on power. It's ridiculous. Going through the list, he's reinstating Muslim bans. He's doing, everything that he did the first time around, but this time he wants to get it right. It's still kind of chaotic, though. I'm not really convinced that they're going to be very effective at this, because they might have been able to be more effective if they had a bigger margin in the House. But there is resistance, and Democrats, there's memo going around to the Democrats that to filibuster, vote against any type of measures to move things out of committee. I mean, they're basically being told to be obstructionists. Now, some Democrats don't want to do that. Fetterman, until today, said he was open to voting for RFK Jr. RFK Jr.'s testimony today went really bad, and he's not committed to that anymore, but some of them are saying, they want to go along and give Trump a chance and blah blah blah, but there are states that are setting up resistance funds, including California, a little bit weakened since they need some cooperation about the fires, But, you know, and are they going to fight our sanctuary? Well, San Francisco today said we reaffirm our sanctuary status, and come what may, we're not going to revise it. We'll see what the Board of Supervisors here says on Tuesday at their meeting. At any rate, you know, this is happening. There's just so much to talk about. I don't know how we can even fit it into the time we have, but he is definitely doing it. He's creating the chaos in order to assume the power. It's a completely different method of ruling, but it is, if I point out what the model resembles, I'm going to be accused of, you're making comparisons to Hitler. So, you know, it's not a question of comparing Trump to Hitler. The process is very much the same thing that got the Enabling Act passed, and the chaos, the burning of the Reichstag, and whether or not that was and this isn't an idea. Again, I'm not saying we're going to be Nazi Germany. I'm just saying that when you've got authoritarianism, the model is pretty solid, and it's basically chaos, so that your opposition is kept off guard, and run 50 yards before you so that you don't get stopped at the 10 yard line. I mean, it's a bad analogy, but Dave, I'm going to let you close it out. If you've got some more specific things to say about the, we've got 2 minutes left, it's about the implementation of Project 2025. They definitely want to clean out the federal employees. That's what this offer is, and yeah, more than 45,000.
Yeah, you anticipated where I was going to go with this, is that they're talking about in the first Trump administration, they had Schedule F, which was an initiative to allow them to more easily fire career civil servants. The firings that have happened, say, within the Justice Department, it's not entirely clear which people were political appointees, which people were career civil servants. But extending the offer to go out and tell people, hey, we'll pay you, through September if you resign, retire now, you'll get this severance package. It's a way to have people kind of voluntarily remove themselves from the federal work.
They're not all volunteering. The firing people in the EEOC and even the inspectors general, they're anticipating lawsuits about that as to whether he had the authority to fire them. But
yeah, no, it's yeah. I pivoted away from the Justice Department, sort of the actual firings, and Schedule F, which is the goal, to like the short term, where they're saying, oh, this is a voluntary program, but it's carrots and sticks. It's a way. I think I saw the estimate was they think about 5% of the people in the federal government will take it. So that's one out of every 20 people that would just step aside and shrink the government. Now there's lots of reasons why maybe shrinking the government's a good idea, but this isn't targeted scalpel. We're not talking about saying let's plan a program and adequately staff it. We're saying let's just destroy the beast, the Leviathan. That's more in line with what they're talking about. But not just on a personnel headcount level, the whole ending of the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, that's across the board. They don't even want people to talk about it. And gender studies, they're saying, like, we don't want people to reference gender. We don't want people to reference race. So to a certain extent, it's a little bit Orwellian, the ripples that have been coming out of the first week and a half of this administration. And just like, not to end on any, and we're going to do a more specific set of in our third segment. But the foreign aid freeze that did go into effect, that is global. We are talking about the entirety of the State Department and all the ways that the United States projects its soft power around the world. So that puts a chill through an entire sector of the global economy. It's a massive statement that's being made, and we're gonna learn more about it as we go through the next few iterations of trying to define it better. But it's really a chill. There's a chill through Washington and around the world when it comes to the United States' role in the world.
And again, there are lawsuits being filed on every one of these. And so far, the two that have reached judges, both of them have been the injunctions against the orders. So far, Trump is 0-2 on that. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, there's a lot going to happen. And yeah, we need, in our third segment, we're going to talk about a vulnerable community.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause. The cause of democracy.
We are going to raise issues that, you know, historically have not been raised.
What about the nuclear option, doing away with the filibuster? I can tell you that would be the end of the Senate as it was originally devised.
All of this is possible for America. Who was standing in the way? Mitch McConnell.
Where an insurrection that sought to overturn an election, when that failed, the action moved into state capitals.
So that vulnerable community, we are talking about LGBTQ and in particular trans people. And the question is that we need to ask, and we know that an order was signed, there are orders coming out and an order basically defining a man as not a man, as somebody who has the smaller reproductive gene at the point of conception organ, and you know, we're all conceived female. It takes 6 months, but I'm sure they're going to revise it as soon as they can to basically define, have a very strict definition of male and female, two genders, no ambiguity, period. He's also issued an executive order that bars particularly trans women from participating in girls or women's sports. And I believe he just signed, if he's not about to sign one, that bans, if it's enforceable on a federal level, trans therapy and care for anyone under 18. I don't think it includes psychological, but it definitely is addressing this. They are going to find ways to attack it, even if any of these orders are defeated in court. And pretty much nobody is going to bat for them. I mean, there's a few people out there public figures, but they're in safe blue districts. But nobody who wants to get elected, because the narrative on, you know, what is a woman has taken such root in Haiti. It is literally the last major bigotry that is not socially taboo right now, because you just say, oh, these poor people, they're the victims of their own psychological problems, and we're not doing any helping them at all by doing this. They basically are saying they don't exist, and that is the fight. So the question is now, you know, trans communities are organizing. They are, you know, they are targeting certain people and they are filing their own lawsuits. But if you want to maybe talk a little bit more about the problem and what the trans communities and their allies are going to do about it from here.
Yeah. So I mean, I think big picture, in the recent past, the transgender population has gained, you know, acceptance and at least a more prominent visibility in society. So there has been real progress in acknowledging people's, you know, humanity and reality. But because of that, they've become targets for social conservatives. So I think we have about 26 states that have adopted laws banning care and really just using it as one of those dog whistle issues. Where it really riles up the base, gets people out in the street or at least showing up to vote. And many of those states, there are lawsuits underway. And the one from Tennessee is actually going before the Supreme Court. And to a lesser extent, the sports conversation occurs. And it's a very divisive conversation, which I think is by design. So there are three executive orders which we could speak to, but I got some basic information from UCLA Law School. It's called the Williams Institute, and they've done a couple studies in recent years. So they say currently, and this is first, I'm going to talk about LGBTQ population. They say about 7% of U.S. adults identify as LGBTQ, up from about 5.5% just 4 years ago. So it's been steadily incrementally increasing as people are more comfortable responding publicly about it. And so one of their other studies says that about 1.6 million people ages 13 and up identify as transgender. So that's about 0.5% of the U.S. population. So for, again, that's 1 out of 200 people. So it's a small population. It's a vulnerable population. And one of the medical conditions that afflicts this population is gender dysphoria. And so it's defined as severe or persistent distress associated with this incongruence, which means like out of alignment between your identity and your biological sex. So it's reality for 1.5 million people. It's 25 million people around the world have this. So the fact that the medical community and the sort of the policy community is and civil rights community has embraced these folks and said you are, you know, you deserve the same civil rights and the same equality as everybody else, the right to thrive and prosper in society. That's come ahead strong into the headwind of the Trump administration. So like you mentioned, that first executive order, which was defining sex as only a male and a female. Well, that completely ignores the fact or discounts the fact that there's a lot of people out there that actually don't fit neatly into that category. It's a reality. So much so. Oh, go ahead.
XX people with male genitalia, XY people with the opposite, XXY people who are born but then get hit. There's hormones that change the way they are while they're still in utero, so they end up, you know, intersex. I mean, there's a lot there, and it just completely defies the science, let alone the humanity of it. And
Absolutely. And I was going to give this one example that Supreme Court in 2020 was hearing a case called Bostock versus Clayton County. And they found that discrimination against someone because they're LGBTQ is sex discrimination under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Even Justice Gorsuch, who's a Republican nominee, he wrote for the majority that it is impossible to discriminate against a person for being homosexual or transgender without discriminating against that individual based on sex. So the Supreme Court is really saying this is a protected group of people. By ignoring the existence of these people, it's just overly simplistic, and it's bigotry on its face. Now, there are nuances that are maybe people just kind of aren't interested, but that doesn't mean that it's not worth engaging. And so the Human Rights Campaign says this executive order is a brazen attempt to put politicians in between people and their doctors, preventing them from accessing evidence-based healthcare supported by every major medical association in the country. So we talk about liberty. We talk about, you know, not getting in the way of a family deciding their own future.
You'll have people who advocate the right to beat their kid. Saying, hey, you're interfering with my parenting, but they don't get to make the medical decisions for the kid. That's going to be made ideologically.
Yeah. And I think it's important to point out, too, the military, because I did see some interviews with soldiers. One of the executive orders is a review of the transgender soldiers in the military, which is widely believed to be the beginning of a ban on service for transgender people. Which, you know, I did see Secretary of Defense Hegseth say that this, you know, almost by definition, these people are not medically fit for service. I think that was one of the things he was saying. But I certainly saw Representative Crenshaw. I saw Representative Crenshaw say that. It's been insinuated, if not explicitly stated. But the reality is there are an awful lot of transgender people in the military who are the reality is that they are exhibiting on the job excellence and success. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. So it's really like fear and ignorance. But it's more than that. It's a little bit of bullying, too. It's a little bit of that team building.
So, no, I got it. So I don't want to run out of time before we get to the point here, because we're talking again about Trump and the transphobic agenda. The Episcopalian bishop at the National Cathedral took a stand saying, you know, begging him for mercy for them and immigrants and the rest. And she's being attacked roundly for it, receiving death threats and the like. But that was resistance. That was somebody who said, hey, I've got them here. They're going to have to listen to me. And you can see Trump just stared off into space. But Vance looks at his wife and his wife is like, you know, hey, don't be reacting. She was actually a little more mature than he was. But there is going to be resistance. And so the question is, you know, what is out there that people can tap into to help them with this? I am convinced that probably in the next 10, 15 years, it will become a consensus that trans people are legitimate and you know, should be allowed to live their lives how they would. And then probably about 10 years after that, Republicans will take credit for having accomplished that, right? I mean, that's their history. So, but what? How do we get there? And how do we? You know, I mean, we're talking about people that are scared, feeling vulnerable that they're going to be attacked, not wanting to travel in certain states right now because they're not going to have the protections. What have you come across? Actual organizations or people that are planning to resist?
So the ACLU was one that I took a look at, and also Human Rights Watch. Yep. So the recommendation from Human Rights Watch was that in this increasingly hostile environment, lawmakers across the political spectrum should reaffirm that transgender people have the right to live free from discrimination and to work and that they work towards enshrining the basic principle into lasting and meaningful protections, which is kind of boilerplate for just speak truth to power, stand up for your values about liberty and equality for all Americans, all people. And just, you know, you can lean on the fact that, you know, the United Nations Human Rights Committee actually has explicitly urged the United States to address our persistently high rates of discrimination and violence against transgender people. We ought not be condoning violence. And if you just look at the reality of it, that exists. So hold people accountable for the violence. But we are in a larger, as you alluded to, we're in this larger environment where really, there's not a recognition of right. Their broader rights. In fact, in one of the executive order stating that there's just a male and a female, only those are the only sexes. The order calls it gender ideology extremism to acknowledge anything non-binary or intersex.
Right.
So it can't be the case that like a medical practice and something we've known about for thousands of years as a reality of the human condition, that somehow that's extreme. What could be considered extreme, I think, is in the margins. It's really how people talk about youth and how people address youth as people go through their process, like assessing their sexuality as they grow up. You know, the numbers I mentioned earlier. You know, it's a very small percentage of the LGBTQ community that identifies as transgender. So maybe as people, you know, grow to become 18 years old, we're more open about the reality that it's not just, you know, X or Y, that there's, you know, people do have all sorts of different ways of expressing themselves and just being open to it. And then when people become an adult, then you say now you have the ability to really thrive. And so I think that's the marginal area where people can meet in the middle and actually figure out a way to both treat people with dignity and also acknowledge that there are real concerns about children. And I think it's rightfully so. We ought to be concerned, but at the same time, not interfere in how people choose to run their family and their communities. Perceptions need to be addressed, but also with compassion and empathy.
Yeah. Now, the big issues are the restrooms, the participation in sports, and I do have to say that there are some legitimate concerns there, at least that I've seen. Renee Richards was she in the 1970s transitioned and won her court case to be able to play in the women's tennis circuit. And she actually says she regrets that now, because she says, I transitioned in my late 30s, so I wasn't dominant. But had I transitioned in my early 20s, nobody would have taken a set from me, not even power players like Martina Navratilova. So I think we need to be able to listen to those things and not be on the defensive about every aspect of it. We need to have a discussion about it. Maybe there are certain sports where it happens and where it doesn't, and where they basically play up in the men's league, like sometimes women do, right? Cis women. So we need to, we need to be able to have the discussion intelligently, because we clearly have not won the culture war on this. We still have to persuade a lot of people. Now, what happened with the gay and lesbian movements is they introduced themselves. They started coming out, started talking to people. I think what needs to happen is, we need to promote the idea that instead of reading about it from, some book, talk to a transgender person, see if you believe that they're mentally ill. And the rest. I mean, really say that, because I mean, we've talked to people who believe that anybody who does that is mentally ill, right? That's just by definition. So there need to be organizations that need to promote that, because we haven't gotten to that point yet where we are. Maybe more than half of the people will accept gay and lesbian people. I mean, even J.D. Vance was talking about normal gays versus whatever else, the rest of the spectrum of LGBTQ. So that's just something we need to put out there, and that there probably are organizations that are going to take on the cultural front to do this. But it's really hard. People are afraid for their kids. People are afraid for, to be in a bathroom with somebody. People we know, cis women who are kind of large and muscular, have been accosted for being in the women's bathroom. And these are people who didn't want to say, oh, I'm a cis woman. They basically argued and said, I have a right to be here, without selling out the community. But there needs to be a strategy for getting this out to people. The allies really need to pick up on that, because the trans people I know in my life are really scared right now. That the bishop is right.
Yeah. And there are going to be, and I know we just have limited time left, but I'll just mention it. There are going to be examples that are going to come up, issues that come up. So one thing the ACLU pointed out is that the Federal Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Homeland Security are now instructed to ignore the guidelines of the Prison Rape Elimination Act and enforce a blanket policy of forcing transgender women into men's prisons and detention centers against their will. So that's like Kafka-esque, that you're saying, oh, we're going to do the right thing based on our values, and we're going to commit people to a period of torture and abuse. So that's the low-lying fruit, things like that. But we're going to see other things where anytime sex or gender are enshrined in law, healthcare access, housing, federal funded programs, anything, educational settings. This is all the ACLU has. ACLU has a big list of areas where they anticipate that they're going to need to step in and represent, because the Trump administration appears to want to push back in all of these areas. Anywhere the federal government has its funding reach, the ACLU is thinking that that's going to be a place to make a stand in the name of liberty and equality for these people that are being targeted now out of bigotry and ignorance.
This brings us to predictions. Dave, what do you have for us?
I'm going to stick with something that we talked about in an earlier segment, that Office of Management and Budget memo that suspended all federal spending that is found to be inconsistent with presidential priorities. Although it's been lifted based on the fact that the lawsuit filed by 22 states' attorney general did move forward, it turns out that that means that the judge thinks there's enough there, even without the memo, to predict that the administration is going to proceed with this plan. So my prediction is that now that the court has determined that the Trump administration is attempting to usurp congressional control over federal spending and that that's a grave threat to the well-being of the citizenry, I think this case has become critically important in affirming the separation of powers and will ultimately lead to an intervention from the Supreme Court in order to avoid a constitutional crisis.
All right. I'll be real quick. RFK Jr. had a really rough hearing today. I mean, he just got sent through and his answers were bad. So it's not like it was just Democrats being mean to him, but even Republicans had some questions about him. My previous prediction was that every single nominee that Trump named will pass. I'm going to stick with that. I do believe he will pass and he will be confirmed. But it's going to be a strict party line based on what Fetterman said today. We'll find out if any of that comes true. Until next time, stay informed and stay engaged.